Definitely.
Now on, so we're all set. I mean, how did you ever get involved with Mordroyden in the first place?
Well, partly because I had been to the city temple and was very impressed with her, and I was interested in women's movements. And so I decided, I think she had made it clear that she wanted someone to look after her little adopted daughter. She and her friend used to live in Poplar, to begin with, because they were keen
That's
on work.
That's Gertrude...
Evelyn Gunter.
Evelyn Gunter, yes.
And they wanted to be down in the East End to see life there. And they heard of this little girl, and they adopted her. And she was very ill for some time, had to be looked after, but the doctors said all that really was the matter with her, she needed to be loved. And gradually she got better, and she was a charming child. I went from college, I suppose. I was at college then, and I said I was doing a Froebel training. And she was a little girl, so 10 months old then. So she said, oh, well, that's fine. You must come along to Hampstead, they were living in then. My father, incidentally, said I'd probably kill the child. I'd never had any experience with babies.
How old were you then?
About 20, now. Mm. But I should think it was about 20. And so it was most exciting, being in the household and looking after, I adored babies, and looking after her. Well, if anybody, I quite often had to be secretary as well and answer the phone. You never knew whether it was going to be Lady Astor or somebody exciting the other end. And there were always very interesting people coming to the house. Harold Anson was one of her friends. He used to come to breakfast sometimes because he lived quite near. But it was a wonderful experience for a
Where
person.
Was the house, actually? In Poplar?
Roslyn Hill. No, she moved to Hampstead then.
I see.
Roslyn Hill, Hampstead. I've got a picture in the one of the books there. And so, I can remember the excitement of going up to the city temple. It was near Christmas time. The traffic was simply frightful. We couldn't move. And I thought, oh, I'm going to be late. But I just about got there, and we had a talk and got on very well. And then I went several holidays after that, and I can't remember the exact date, but Percy Dearmer had been abroad and came back about this time, had no church to go to, you see. And he said to Mordroyden, well, now look here, you've been in a congregational church, you're a church, she was an Anglican, and she had been very influenced by Percy Dearmer, who was very broad-minded, but a high Anglican, and a great authority on all church ritual, and his churches were full of beauty. He was at Primrose Hill.
Oh, yes, yes. Mm.
And so he said, the time has now come when you must just branch out. If our own denomination won't have you, well, let's start something. And she said, well, I can only undertake it if you'll promise to come and be with, start it with me. And so they were able to get Kensington Town Hall, and a committee was formed. I was a member of it.
Were you really?
Yes. Mm. And we used to meet in Percy Dearmer's house. He was then married to Mabel Dearmer, who wrote plays. And very interesting people. We had all denominations, I think, on the committee. I think that the editor of the... what was the paper called? The Christian World, I think, at that time. Mm. He was either the secretary or the treasurer. And gradually it took sort of form. And we started at Kensington Town Hall very, very soon. That was much too small.
Started what, if
the,
I may?
Oh, I'm so sorry, yes. Started the Sunday services.
I see. What, in the town hall?
In the Kensington Town Hall. That was the beginning. Mm. And it was entirely interdenominational. We had all races and all denominations coming to it. Percy Dearmer based the evening service on a slightly modified evensong. There was silence put into it. On the whole, it was the same format. And one thing you had during the collection, you were invited to talk to your neighbours so that you began to know people in, because they objected to singing a hymn with pennies clinking into the plate. That was sacrilege to music, I think. And we used probably used English hymns. I don't think the Songs of Praise. He did the Songs of Praise afterwards, which we had at the Guild House. That went on possibly for 2 years, but the actual dates, I've got the thing written
yes,
it out
right,
for you.
That, no,
no. Then we had the great difficulty of finding somewhere that was really large enough and in a suitable place. And the Guild House was a congregational church originally in Eccleston Square near Victoria. It was quite a good proportioned building. It had the gallery going round, as many of them had, and sort of pillars down. Mm. I can't remember. I think probably there might have been steps up to it in the front, but I always went in the back way. Had to be there early. And with great excitement, we had our first services there. But beforehand, we had to do a tremendous amount of clearing up. And Percy Dearmer had great ideas of brightness in churches. So everything was whitewashed white. And he had very exciting sort of lanterns over the lighter shades and with sort of bright blues and reds in them. The only thing I think that was left rather dull was the pulpit. As in many congregational churches, it was in the centre of the church and you went up steps and leaned over. And then there was the vestry, and of course that went from strength to strength. I mean, people would be queuing up at 6 o'clock for about a 6:30 service, and it would hold 1,200, and for the first few years it was always full. We had an afternoon service called Five Quarters, which was very often a quarter of... We had a paid quartet and of singers, and they would contribute some of the music, and then there might be a poetry reading, or there might be someone to talk, but it was divided up into sections. After that, a large tea was provided in the hall down below, and then the big service took place at 6:30. Maud Royden practically always preached, but of course sometimes she had commitments in other parts of England, or she was in America, and then Percy Dearmer would more likely have talked in the afternoon, but he also preached in the evening. We had a band of stewards. Maud Royden had a black cassock and a little black sort of semi-beretta, but not like a man's beretta. We had bright blue cassocks, and I was usually rather one of the chief ones. So I used to do a bit of vestry work for her and see that everything was going all right. After the evening service, we had an after meeting when everybody could speak if they wished to, or ask questions. There was general discussion on the sermon.
Was there any?
Yes. And that was a pretty full day. One started quite early. And it was
not in the morning, though?
No, because they wouldn't have anything in the morning, because they reckoned that people belonged to their own churches, and it was right for them to do their own church if they wished to in the morning. And anyhow, there couldn't be any communion service, you see, at the Guild House, because Maud Royden wouldn't be allowed to do that.
I understand, yes.
So that she felt that everybody should have the right to go to their own church in the morning. And of course it did mean a long journey up to Victoria for a great number of people.
Yes, could you just stop there? I mean, who came then? I mean, is it a local clientele?
Oh, no, they came from all over London, you see, and... She belonged to the pacifist suffragettes. She had great friends there, and she also knew a great number of the militant suffragettes. We had a lot of suffragettes, people who had been in prison, and some of them were active, or they were on the committee, some of these people who were really organizing with her. But then it would the sort of interested people out of all different denominations came, those with a modern outlook and an ecumenical interest. so that it grew and grew, the number of people that
Mainly women or not?
Well, it was interesting, yes. I wouldn't say mainly, but I suppose about... I should think 75 to 25. But there were good representations of the men on the committees. My father used to help as well, and was Percy Dearmer's followers came. You see, he had a very strong following because of his work at Primrose Hill and various other churches. And then Martin Shaw, of course, was the music director. He and Geoffrey Shaw sometimes came. So that we had a very widespread. And then, of course, we had Albert Schweitzer, who came on one or two occasions, and one of our charities was to help his hospital at Lamparini. And then we had Grenfell, all the outstanding sort of people taking their day. And then we had monthly meetings, and we've had very interesting people. I had rather fun because I sold the tickets for those, and then I used to get coffee with these people afterwards. We had Galsworthy and Sybil Thorndike and Gilbert Murray. A tremendous range of people that came. I mean, that was one of the great attractions. You see, it was an absolute, all through the week there were things going on there. I mean, every kind of society was formed. We had a League of Nations. I started a junior branch of the League of Nations. I went round the streets of Victoria and just sort of dragged the little children in with them and said, would you like to come and have a nice evening? And we started by just having games, and gradually, I mean, I got them. It was terrific. I had a great deal of discipline to cope with, because there were pillars down in the hall below, just freshly decorated by Percy Dearmer, and their idea was to sort of swarm up these pillars. But in the end, I got them to go to libraries and look up projects and give little lectures. And we did take them to the at international exhibition that was on at Wembley. And occasionally a man came to help me, but I didn't find that they were very much used in coping with the children. But that was one thing. Then, of course, it became the centre of the League of Arts. Percy Dearmer was very interested in the League of Arts. And that,
what was that, actually?
Well, that was bringing art to a greater number of people. We used to do plays in Hyde Park. I can remember walking about as Hermia, and then we were a ghost. I was a ghost in the nightdress walking around Hyde Park in the Bluebird, I think it was. But they were the League of Arts did a great deal of work. There again, you can, I think, read up the details in Percy Dearmer's.
You're giving a marvellous picture of how it all sort of spread out, you know.
Yes, well, it was so endless. I mean, it was the people that were keen were all organisers, all women that were anxious to have some outlet without sort of being held in by things. And there was the Guild House that was there where they could experiment and do these things.
Yes, can you explain that a bit? I mean, you mean that it actually provides an opportunity for women to realise themselves,
yes,
more than,
yes,
some other institutions?
Yes,
well,
oh yes.
Why,
yes,
was that? Because
Well, because Royden, I mean, that was there as a woman, and the idea was freedom of trying things out that were going to make the world a better place, really. Mm. And you see, she was particularly friendly with Dick Shepherd and Ponsonby and all those people. Gradually, you see, that the Peace Pledge Union, yeah, worked out of that, and of course the Guild House gave support to all these things that were started, because they were people who were keen on making the world a more peaceful and a more beautiful place, so that they got the nucleus all the while to back them up. these things.
So it's a way of making contact with all sorts of other institutions.
Oh, yes, yes, that was what's so terribly interesting. So you it was so alive with the best brains of that particular time. It was, and 1920, I think, was a wonderful time for things happening educationally and...
Yes, what do you mean? Because you thought a new world was about to grow out
Yes,
of
I think
war.
From the war, you see, there was a great surge forward that don't let this happen again. Let us have something that's really a world worth living in. I think all that came out of that. I mean, it was a time of the educational change that took place then. So you had Home Elaine, you had the Peirce School, you had modern psychologists. It was, everything was full of good intentions and good ideas and trying out the best. I mean, when you hear them talking now about this wonderful, you know, all this self-expression in education, I mean, in that period, it was done so much better because there was still the restraint of knowing the basic things as well as going... I mean, now they get such one idea and they go all out without getting a balance. Mm. Because there was also Dominique's Logman, you know, who was he and... Dominique, the man that wrote all those educational books, he was at King Alfred's school. I really know him, but he was another pioneer in this sort of developing the child.
So it's a very progressive atmosphere, really.
Very progressive, in the
Not
high
Not necessarily
set.
Labour, but presumably liberal,
Well, of course, yes, I would say that there was, I mean, there were conservatives as well. There was a strong Labour side, there was a strong liberal side. I mean, it was I think of them as Christian socialists, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
I think that was a term that perhaps was applied to many of them in
liberal with a small L.
That's right. Yes, that's right.
That's modern. So really, it's like a lot of nonconformist churches were at that time. That is very much a centre of cultural activity as well as religious activity, but broader.
Yes, and on a very high, her religious inspiration was wonderful, really. Mm. She had a little group that was called the Little Community, and we used to meet at her house. She had a room in her house called the Oratory. It was a very simple one. With just a cross and white and blue, it was very nice. We used to have half an hour's meditation, and then people could speak on some perhaps given thing that we had been thinking about in that time. That was what might be called her inner circle of friends and people. And we used to go down to High Ashurst and various places for retreats sometimes. So that was another little branch of things that came out of it.
This was her house in Rosslyn Hill, that had this oratory, wasn't it? How many people were in that?
About, I should think, 30, something like that.
And they were the sort of hardcore of the...
Well, they were, I really oughtn't to have been there because I was very immature. I mean, they were very much more spiritually developed than I was at the time, but I was questing, I suppose, I did lots of organising and working for Maud at the Guildhouse because I like that kind of thing. If you're an organiser, you enjoy it and you get on with it. But
could you just describe briefly what there is at the Guildhouse? There's a basement sort of thing.
Yes, it was an ordinary sort of, you went in the ordinary congregational church, and then very luckily down below there was this big hall which would take quite a number of people. It was filthy and it was ugly, but I never forget sort of organising was Martin Shaw and his wife and Percy Dearmer, and all these people all got down with scrubbing brushes and got it all clean, and then Percy got them all painting and made it. And of course there were lots and lots of rooms, side rooms. When you read that little account you'll see references made to that. And they were all used for various things.
All opening off the basement?
Some of them halfway up. And Yes, some of them were out by the vestry and various places like that. I left London in 1927. I took over the school, so that I wasn't really there in its slightly declining years.
20s was a great period.
Yes, 1919, I think, roughly when it started, and right up. But she, Dick Shepherd, you see, was out a pulpit, and he had that's terribly bad health. He was, he had no pulpit, and I know she wrote to him, because he was terribly wrapped up in this peace thing. And she said, well, now, why not come and use the Guildhouse as your pulpit, because you've got the ear of a great number of people all over England, and you could, nothing's going to stop you, you can go ahead. But he felt that, in spite of the attractiveness of the invitation, that he couldn't take it. And then I think he became Dean of St. Paul's after that.
St. Martin's of the Fields?
Well, that was how he started there,
oh,
you
I see.
See.
Yes,
but
yes,
he ended up
as
a Dean of St. Paul's.
Yes, yes.
And
so really you had a, what was it, a sort of like a meeting hall, really, in the basement?
Yes.
With pillars and
that's
things.
That's right,
where
yes.
Where you could organise
anything
sort of
we wanted to. And then, of course, we had a strong dramatic group, too.
Did
we
really?
Produced plays there.
Yes, yes.
And, yes, I remember that we did a nativity play. I worked with Peter Schutzer, who was at the Lister Institute, and Henrietta Leslie, who was a novelist, who's written quite a lot. We got some children in, and they did a play, and I think that was probably the money was going for the Save the Children Fund. That was, because Percy Dearmer himself was outstandingly good with young children. I'm not sure that whether we had one connected with the Guildhouse, but he himself had a group, and I think he had to broadcast too on those things.
Can you describe the personalities a bit? I mean, I've been writing things down just to remind me to ask you, what was Percy Dearmer like as a person?
Well, he was just a great artist, really. Which his religion and beauty and art were all linked up together. But I don't really think you can do better than...
Look at the book.
You see, if I can lend you that book.
I think I've actually got that. Let me just have a look.
It's by Lamb.
Divide up, you know, what they each contributed to the running of the Guildhouse. What's their role, the two of them, then?
Well, they would... I mean...
Percy did the afternoons, mainly, did he? And more
yes,
the more,
yes, but he would sometimes take the evening as well. But I think he reckoned that it was her position in the evening, and he would definitely organised all kinds of things for the five quarters. Can you remember we had an interesting talk on modern music by Geoffrey Shaw or Martin Shaw, I'm not quite sure which, and we had Osbert Sitwell. And Hugh Pakenham, I think, was the outstanding architect, wasn't he, at the time? They all came and contributed their bits.
How did they get all these people?
Oh, well, that's
extraordinary.
But you see, they were all... You see, Percy Dearmer had a tremendous circle of friends, and Maud Royden had too. I mean, the men really just flocked round as she could do. I don't mean in an unpleasant way,
no.
But I mean, she just had that magnetism that they all... fell in with whatever they could do for her, and she had a very wide circle, because she was at Lady Margaret Hall.
Yes, she was, yes.
And,
yes.
And her family was, he was, the brother was the
he
canard,
was shipping,
or
shipping, yes.
Shipping, I think.
Yes.
And so that they all had a range, you see, in the Shores, I mean, their music was that, so everybody produced anybody that would come, and people did enjoy coming, because it was a novel experience, and it was a free place where they could speak. Sybil Thorndyke came and read Browning to us.
She picture. Yeah. Yeah. Incredible range of talent. But could we go, yes, go right back to the beginning a little?
Yes, because running around planned all over the place.
Yes,
for
ideal. You're doing a marvellous job, actually. You plunged straight into the middle in a way, but I mean, how did you ever come to hear Maud Royden in the first place? I mean, you were telling me earlier, weren't you?
Yes.
How did it all arise? I mean,
well, my father would encourage me to go to different places. I mean, we went to the King, we went to Dr. Orchard, the King's Way House. Out of interest, I went to a Christian scientist place. And then when we heard that this American at the City Temple was an outstanding preacher, which he was full of knowledge of English literature, and we went, and then you see...
Who was that?
Dr. Fort Newton.
Oh, yes, yes. F-O-R-T-E.
Yeah, that'll be in the book. Yes. And then, of course, he got Maud as his assistant. And so she stayed there until he went back to America, and that was the time that Percy Dearmer had come back from America and felt that the moment had come for her to out on her own and make her own.
Well, your father sounds a very liberal-minded sort of person.
Oh, he was marvellous. What were his ideas, really, then?
I mean, was he a nonconformist?
No, we were all baptised in the Church of England, yes.
Mm.
And my mother. No, he believed in finding out who was, and listening to the best people, the most interesting people. But, of course, literature was his great love, so that, I mean, anybody that had a literary bent was the thing that attracted him. He was educated at King's School at near Warwick, you know, the one there, and he ran a literary society there, which was a great success. And when he came up to London, he had a post in the civil service. He started a literary society amongst his own friends. I don't think there were any more, very rarely more than 12 of them, and they used to meet in Dr. Johnson's house in Gough Square every Friday.
So he was a very cultivated man, but also a very broad-minded.
Oh yes, yes. Mm. They started by only studying Shakespeare, and then it enlarged the Greek tragedies. And he once, after about some years, we had a ladies' night, which was a great opening. We went there, had dinner up there.
So can you remember first hearing Maud Royden preach or speak?
Well, yes, I think it would be at the would be round about. I should think about 1919 and. I mean, she made such an impression that I just felt I must get to know her. And then the opening came when she wanted someone to look after her little adopted daughter while her nurse was away. And so
off it went.
And then after
How did she make this impression? You see, this is a very difficult thing to recapture, isn't it?
Well, has an outgoing personality. She had that great art of making you feel that you were an important person. She herself would sit and listen to your opinions when you knew perfectly well that you were a very immature person. But she just put you at your ease and made you feel that you had a lot to contribute. And I mean, you hardly ever organized or did anything without her writing an absolutely charming letter to thank you for all that you had done and what pleasure you'd given to other people, you see, for running a social or something of that type. She was an extrovert. You've read that book of hers, haven't you, The Three...
Yes,
what was your impression of her?
She
hardly brought... I mean, I was with her a great deal, but she never let that side of their great love come into the work of the Guildhouse. I mean, only her intimate friends really knew about that. But I mean, she could easily have made a lot of it, but one just knew that she didn't. He inspired her a lot to carry on the work at the Guildhouse. I had, when it was a great event, when we won, were allowed to have the 3-hour service. She took the 3-hour service at St. Botolph's. That was his church in the city. And I was the steward that had to have my seat very near the pulpit, just in case anything happened in the way of a disruption, because she had a great many people who thought it was a dreadful thing for a woman to take a 3-hour service. But of course, not being one of the special services, it was an extra sort of service. It was nothing really breaking the law, and I think she had the blessing of one of the bishops to do it. Of course, she did it very beautifully, and the church was packed. So,
in fact, it came as quite a shock, didn't it, to some of the Guildhouse people that she had the
relationship with Shaw at all. Yes, I think so. Yes.
She didn't exactly keep it quiet, particularly, but she just didn't...
She didn't let it in any way come between her and her work. I mean, it helped her, it inspired her. I mean, the love of... It was almost like a Shelley, wasn't it? It was almost... I mean, it was a high transcendental love, really, and truly, that was going on between the three of them. But
so he wasn't involved with the Guildhouse at all?
Very little. He'd come to occasionally, but I mean, he wasn't. He had his own work, and he had his own difficulty with his invalid wife a great deal. Just like Dick Shepherd, I mean, was such an invalid and so terribly delicate. I mean, I was terribly interested. It was just recently, wasn't it? It was in the paper that. His wife went off with A.G. Macdonnell. We had A.G. Macdonnell. He wrote England, Their England.
Oh, yes, I think I did read that.
I was amazed because I wasn't... I knew he hadn't got a very happy married life at times, but we had the child at school for a little while, A.G. Macdonnell. Because Dick was living at the Red House in Godalming.
I see.
It was in Clapton Brock's house, I think, down there.
Yes. But you've described very well how she was like with you in a sort of personal way. But I mean, what was she like actually as a preacher?
Well, she was magnetic.
Why did she have that great influence?
Well, I don't know, because she spoke so sincerely and with such... I mean, there was emotion. I mean, now some people might say that she was perhaps a little too emotional. I rather, when I listen to some of the preachers now, I feel that so many of them lack emotion. I'm not sure that you're going to be any use to people unless you do have just the best kind of emotion in your voice and in your sermons. I mean, these cold-blooded discourses don't really get very far, I don't think. We have so many of them. I mean,
so it was sort of uplifting.
It was an absolute inspiration. You'd really... She had the most lovely expressive hands, and she would lean over the pulpit like that, and she'd say, "My people, I am persuaded that." And you know, you really felt that it was sincere, and it really did matter, the whole thing. No, her preaching was excellent, because her flow of language was good, her literary background and her historical background all came in. And then... I can't remember whether we had the silence after the sermon or before. I mean, I always think that's one of the failings of the Church of England. They don't have enough silence in their services. I think it's...
Did she have a sort of, in a sense, theatrical voice, very varied in tone and that sort of thing?
I would call it a very musical voice.
Musical.
I mean... She got her stresses in the right places, and she got her pauses in the right... I mean, she was a born speaker, which you can't say for many people, really.
What about looks, actually, Miss Hines? I mean, was she a nice-looking woman as well while she was speaking? She has very fine eyes, doesn't she?
Oh, lovely eyes.
Yes.
And she was so human and had a great sense of humour. I mean, when she was very tired, one of her great treats was to go to bed and have a detective story read to her. I remember doing that many an evening. She loved that. And she loved fashion, looking at fashion when the sale notices and things came. I mean, she was a feminist as well as being... She was distinctly a feminist. I mean, she was a woman.
So when she was preaching, she used her arms and hands quite a lot, did she?
Not a lot, but when she used them, they expressed something. I mean, it would be a small movement, but not a theatrical one.
No,
I mean, it didn't worry you. You didn't feel that she was... No, she was. She did it mostly with her voice.
Because one does get the impression, reading the Guildhouse printed versions of her talks, that she has this capacity to... relate rather large issues to one's personal life,
yes.
One's day-to-day.
Right. Oh yes, yes. Detail, little life. You've got a little book here called Life's Little Pitfalls.
Yes,
was one of hers, that's the little things, showing people how to make the best of their lives and their situations.
I mean, she talks about rather large moral questions. Mm. But applies them to people's small day-to-day decisions
in a very clever way, that is what is lacking so often, isn't it? Mm. I mean, so many of these sermons are packed with biblical stories, but the average person doesn't have the quickness to interpret it to everyday life. But she had that, and she was terribly conscious of suffering, the suffering of the world. Because their idea was to have a peace army, which they would put between
the two sides,
was a very strong meaning for them.
But do you think one of the attractions must have been a sort of educational attraction in a way? That is, a lot of women or people living in suburbs or whatever were starved educationally, particularly with lack of women's opportunities and so on.
Oh, yes.
And they'd get a sort of nourishment on a Sunday of a sort of semi-cultural
which would take them through the week and make them look forward to coming back the next Sunday to help. And she would be awfully good about, following up where she knew there was a difficult case or sadness. I mean, little details were never overlooked by her. And of course, Evelyn Gunter, her friend, was a charming person, also had a great feeling for
humanity. Can you tell me a bit about her? They shared a house in Roslyn Hill.
Yes, and afterwards they did too, because finally she went down to Bailey's Hill in Sevenoaks. She got a cottage next to Hudson Shores. Mm. Evelyn...
What did she do?
Was rather her... We always said she was distinctly the Martha to Maud's Mary. She ran the house at Roslyn Hill and did a certain amount of secretarial work. And you had to have always somebody there, because there was constant phoning and people coming. They had quite a lot of, I remember once I was there, and a whole contingent of outstanding Indian women came to tea. And all sort of talked about the work they were doing. I mean, it was just endless, really, the contacts that she had in not only this country, but other countries as well.
So how were they together, these two? I mean, were they a pair, really?
Evelyn was very quiet, quite strong-minded in her own way, but quite different from Moore, but absolutely charming, too. Then they had Kathleen Fale, who was the chauffeur, most hair-raising and running. She just took us to Oxford, would go the wrong way up on the street. She would so. Maud, I think, drove, in spite of her lameness, I think Maud did drive herself as well. Mm. And then they had, I think they had another woman living in. And, of course, when Helen was small, they had this Scotch nurse. I'll tell you another person that used to be there quite a lot, Kathleen Courtney,
met her before she died, yes.
She was connected up with the League of Nations, wasn't she?
She was very prominent in the League of Nations Union.
She was a nice woman,
her. Oh yes, distinguished woman.
Oh yes, she was. Well, they were great friends, Kathleen and Maud were tremendous.
One thing that interests me, you see, about the women in between the wars is that very often you get these partnerships between women.
Yes.
Who achieve a great deal. There's Elizabeth McAdam and Eleanor Rathbone. For example, or there's Eva Hubbock and Eleanor Rathbone, to take another example, or there are pairs
who do things and complement each other. Yes, well, that's different.
Was that what it was
definitely
like with her?
With Maud, yes, it was a balance between them.
Interesting, yes. Mm.
And I mean, sometimes one felt that Evelyn was almost pushed into, not by really meaning to, but she was almost in the background when she herself, in her own way, could contribute a tremendous amount.
She managed more.
She did the managing, yes.
How did she do that? She was just a very good organiser, was she?
Yes. Mm. And she would look after all her packing and things like that. I mean, she had people, and they're as busy as that, and wear themselves out. I mean, they've got to have somebody who take off the chores for them, really and truly.